At midnight on the 1st of July 1916, darkness had finally arrived on the Somme battlefield. Between Gommecourt in the north and Montauban in the south, the fighting had finally come to an end after the worst day in the history of the British Army. Nearly 20,000 men were either dead or dying of wounds, and getting on for 40,000 others were still wounded and unaccounted for, and about 600 had been taken prisoner of war by the Germans. Opposite Fricourt, about 20 survivors of the 10th Battalion of the West Yorkshire Regiment were asleep in a field. The senior officers as yet didn't know the scale of the disaster that had occurred. My great-uncle Henry hadn't been in action that day. He was in reserve at Millencourt, not far from Auvillers. In a few hours' time, he would be in action. He would see for himself what had happened on the 1st of July 1916. There were tens of thousands of British soldiers on the move, but not the move they thought they would be making, in one direction, eastwards towards the German lines, through the German lines and on towards Berlin. No, that hadn't happened. Breakdown in the organisation in some sectors of the British trenches was complete. They hadn't planned for such a complete failure. The wounded were being evacuated. Those involved in the attacks were being relieved, those that survived, that is, and fresh troops, like my uncle Henry, were taking over those frontline trenches. Up at Serre, a company from a whole battalion that had not been involved in the attack were asked to move in to the frontline trenches in case the Germans counterattacked. There was a private W.E. Aust, and he told the famous historian Martin Middlebrook, he said, "At dusk we moved down the remnants of the trench to the front line. The last 100 yards was solid with men killed whilst waiting to go over. It was impossible to do other than walk on these bodies, and I finally reached a man on a stretcher with a bearer lying dead at each end. I raised my foot to place it on the chest of the man on the stretcher, when, to my amazement, he popped his head up and said quietly, 'Mind my leg, chum,' and then just laid back again. Reaching the front line, we had a job to find a habitable bit of trench. We got our rockets fixed and sentries posted, and then set out to spend the longest night of our lives." Lance Corporal J.A. Henderson was serving with the Belfast Young Citizens at Teepval, opposite the Schwaben Redoubt, and he said, "Our quartermaster had promised champagne to those who came back. Sure enough, when I got back, champagne was there. Every now and again, another straggler came in and we got talking about those who had been hit. Many of us broke down and started howling, but some were ready to go back next day and look for the wounded. One man in particular, a fat man called Hamilton, was ready to go, but we had to laugh because his rifle had been hit and it was twisted like a corkscrew, and he didn't know it." Private T.A. Senior, serving with the 9th Battalion of the Yorks and Lancs, said, "We stayed up during the night to wait for the battalion to come in. They straggled in. First there would be a man on his own, and then maybe a couple, one helping another who was exhausted. I vividly remember some of them screaming and demented with shell shock. They'd obviously had the shock of their lives. None of the chaps in my draft who had been trained with me and who had only just joined the battalion came back. My shorthand saved me." Senior was one of the 10% that had been left in reserve, as the other 90% went forward. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And what I wanted to do this week was to look at what happened during the night of the 1st into the 2nd of July 1916. I'd spent quite a time recently reading accounts again of what happened on the 1st. And then I suddenly had a thought. We really know what happened at 7:30 on that day and the hours that followed. Well, what happened after that? When the sun went down and the guns stopped firing, 40,000 British soldiers were wounded, as we said, but where were they? How did they cope, lying out in no man's land? What was it like stuck there all night? What was happening in the reserve and support lines? I needed to find out. So I started to look through published accounts and primary sources. And what I discovered was a story of suffering, survival and death that I couldn't imagine to understand. what it must have been like to be there. We keep saying this, don't we? And what I wanted to do today was to share their stories with you. But as usual, we're not going to look at their stories through the history books. We're going to look at their stories through their eyes and their words. That night, men were scattered all over the battlefield. In the southern part of the battlefield, it was going to be possible during the night to help the wounded, because in areas like Montauban, the action had been successful. The line had been pushed back. The dead and wounded could be dealt with, but not so in the northern part of the battlefield. It had been a very hot day. Water bottles had been emptied, rations eaten. Maybe a wounded soldier could reach more supplies from dead comrades, if he dare move, that was. As the sun went down, it was a chance to move. The stretcher bearers went out to find wounded men. They found that so many of them had succumbed through dehydration and their wounds. It must have been really difficult for those stretcher bearers. First of all, they had to get through their own barbed wire that had been battered. Then there were new shell holes and the old shell holes to find their way in and out. And they found badly wounded men hiding in these shell holes, trying to shelter from the German fire. There was still occasional firing during the night. The rest of the ground was torn up badly as well. And no doubt they had to find their way through body parts of men that had been mutilated by highly powered machine guns and artillery shells. And then they had to work out who was dead or alive, and from the wounded, try and work out if they could actually be saved. There was only 6 hours of darkness because this was high summer, and yet they didn't know it, but we do now. There was tens of thousands of men that needed help. Middlebrook says in his book, The First Day of the Somme, that the stretcher bearers couldn't help treading on wounded men, and sadly some of them were trod into the slime and mud because it had been raining for a few days before the battle. And then I started to think also about those men that were in reserve, like my Uncle Henry. They would have seen the wounded coming back from the trenches. They'd have seen the horror, haggard looks on their faces, as that famous poem said. But of course, worst of all, they knew that next it would be their turn. Slowly but surely, those men that could move in that darkness, they managed to crawl back to their own lines. That's if they could work out which way to go. Some of them crawled the wrong way and ended up being taken prisoner by the Germans. At the Heidenkopf at Saire, it was said that it was 4 days after the 1st of July before the final wounded soldier crawled out of shell holes and back to British lines. 4 whole days he'd been out there. How on earth did he survive? And as I was reading these accounts, there was lots of descriptions of the sounds that were coming from No Man's Land that night. I don't know about you, but I've stood there on the battlefield and wondered what those sounds were like. It's impossible to know, of course, but maybe it was a little bit like this. It really doesn't bear thinking about, does it? But that's exactly what we're going to do this week. We're going to try and think about it, try and put ourselves in the position of those men. A few months ago, we did a couple of podcasts about the Accrington Pals, and there was a Lance Corporal Berry, and he said a group of staff officers appeared and we stood to attention. One of them asked our corporal, "Why haven't these men shaved?" He said, "I could have shot him without compunction." Another one, a Private H.C. Blore, he said, "I was out in No Man's Land until late on the 2nd of July, and I made up my mind I had to move. I was hurt in the foot, and I more or less fell into our trench. There were no troops manning it, and no stretcher bearers, but lots of wounded. There was a chap sitting on a box, but he didn't reply when I spoke to him. I spent that night in a dugout with some other wounded. Next morning, I crawled up into the trench, and the man was still sitting on the box. He'd been dead all the time. An officer told me If you want to get out of here, lad, crawl. Private A. Fretwell, he was with the Sheffield City Battalion next to the Accrington Pals at Sayre, he said, I kept falling into shell holes, which had men in them. When I tried to get them to come with me, I found that they were all dead. Sometimes there were 8 or 9 in one hole. Second Lieutenant J.W. Stansby, he was serving with the 1st 6th Battalion of the North Staffs. He said, I lay by the German wire from about 7:45 a.m. So he's been wounded within the first 15 minutes of the attack. I think North Staffs, if I remember rightly, attacked at Gommecourt in the north. He said, I was there till after nightfall, receiving a shrapnel wound in the foot and a bullet wound in the hand during the course of the day. When darkness fell, the Germans threw volleys of hand grenades into the wire and then came out to pick up the pieces. I was carried into the German frontline trench and taken down to a dugout where I was searched and my wound was dressed. At the opposite end of the battlefield at Montauban, Private R.G. Robertson was serving with the 4th Liverpool Pals, and they were one of the units that had taken Montauban. And he told Martin Middlebrook, when he interviewed him for his book, we got a ration of rum, which may have been slightly larger than usual, owing to there being several casualties. We were, nevertheless, quite sober, but feeling very pleased with ourselves at having taken our objective. We were so pleased with this and the fact that so many of us were still alive, and we started singing some of those wartime songs, including Keep the Home Fires Burning. Just imagine that scene. They didn't know what had gone on around them. For all they knew, the battle, the first day of that battle, had been a tremendous success, the great push. They were on their way to victory. Just imagine them sitting there, eating their hot rations, gulping down that rum, and singing just as old soldiers can.
Keep the home fires burning.
Now, sticking with information in Martin Middlebrook's famous book, The First Day on the Somme, we learn that by the end of the second day, the 2nd of July, there were still approximately 10,000 wounded from that first day of the battle, still in the battle zone, waiting to be evacuated. And it was not until the 4th of July that all of the wounded were being properly cared for. And even those men that had managed to get out of the battle zone was suffering very much hardship. Private A.R. French of the 7th Royal West Kents, he said, after being wounded, I walked to Bray, where I spent 5 nights in a field with only a ground sheet and a blanket. By then, my arm was in a very bad state. Sergeant H. Benzing was serving with the Grimsby Chum when he was wounded close to the Lochnagar crater at Laboiselle. He said, I was brought in from No Man's Land on Monday the 3rd of July, so he'd been out there for well over 2 into the third day. He said, I had a rough dressing put on a bullet wound in my foot, but no more. The same day, I was taken to a casualty clearing station at Corby and remained there until Friday night with no medical attention at all. When I was taken to the base hospital at Wimmeroo, the dressing was removed and my foot and all the way up my leg was completely gangrenous. Within a few hours, I had to have a mid-thigh amputation from what had been a simple wound in my foot. What he's saying here, Middlebrook, in his book, that the British medical services were completely overrun with the sheer volume of wounded which they hadn't really anticipated. And just imagine what it was like when the survivors held their roll call either on the afternoon of the 1st of July or on the following day. These roll calls were often held in the villages or the billets where they'd marched from only a day or two before. And some units had got less than 100 men. out of the original strength of more than 700. Just imagine that as the names were called out, met by silence. Sometimes the fate of the men that were absent, it wasn't known. They didn't know what had happened to them. They were just marked down as missing, and so many of those are still missing. They're on the Tietvel Memorial. And I mentioned earlier that 10% of the men from each battalion had been left out. And a lot of those felt guilt and shame because they'd been spared the ordeal that they're now seeing that so many of their pals had gone through. And of course, so many of their pals were not there anymore. The 1st Rifle Brigade, one platoon, had been 40 strong before the battle. At roll call, just one man answered his name. I can't remember if it was last year or the year before I walked through Newfoundland Park and recorded a podcast through the eyes of one of the men that survived the slaughter of the Newfoundlanders in what's now called Newfoundland Park. And his name was Ginger Byrne. He wrote a book which he called I Survived, Didn't I? And in that podcast, we left Ginger at the end of the day when he'd managed to find his way back to his own lines. He'd waited until after dark. And this is what he said he found when he finally made his way back into the trench that he'd left. That morning, he says, and what a bloody fine mess it was too. Blown all ways with shellfire and dead laying everywhere. I was getting used to dead bodies by that time. I was only too glad to be out of no man's land and away from that flipping German machine gunner. So I made my way along as best I could, and I came to a live corporal. He was a stretcher bearer, that's all I know of him. I never knew his name. He was trying to bandage a bloke who was lying at the bottom of the trench, put it a bandage at the back of his shoulder. And he looked up at me and said, "Are you the bloke that was shouting through the wire just now? Have you been out there all day?" He says, "I'd got my gas bag tied around my neck, but I'd got no equipment. Mine was out in no man's land, somewhere in my first little hole. I knew which way to go because I was facing the 18-pounders, so I knew I was going back all right. I found a trench to the right, and then I came to a place where it looked as though they'd tried to make a bit of an advanced dressing station. That's a place where they carried the wounded on stretchers and patched them up a bit. There was lots of equipment and rifles laying about, so I picked up a set of equipment and put it on, and also a rifle. But I made sure there was no bloody wire cutters at the end of this one." Burns says he had a good feed of pork and beans and a belly full of tea, and he says he got some fags so he was all right and was quite content. He then asked where his company was, but no one seemed to know. He said, "I met a corporal and I asked him. He told me that nobody knew where anybody was. Him and his lot were waiting for some prisoners. So I said, sarcastic like, 'Oh yes, you'll find some prisoners, you will, I don't think. You don't want to worry yourself about that.' Then I wandered off and I found an old barn. It was pitch dark. I thought, this will do me. I shoved my feet round to make sure no one was lying there. Core, I hadn't realised it until that moment, but I was flipping exhausted. I was absolutely beat. I took my equipment off, undid my belt and lay down, using my haversack as a pillow. I put my tin hat over my face to keep the rats off. I crossed my hands and I said a prayer that my father had taught me. And it goes like this. Here I lie down to sleep. I give my soul to God to keep. God within, God without. May God surround me all about. There are four corners to my bed. There are four angels overhead. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. Bless the bed that I lie on. If any danger touches me, may the Lord awaken me. So let me live. So let me sleep. I give my soul to God to keep. Forever. Amen." This was my little prayer, he says, every night. I said it pretty quickly and then I was gone, unconscious, spark out. That was the end of Ginger Byrne's 1st of July 1916. Richard Van Endem is a very well-known historian and author who came on the podcast some time ago when we talked about boy soldiers. And one of his other books about the Somme describes the battle in the soldiers' own words and lots of private photographs as well. And Richard covers what happened at night time in great detail in the book, and he talks about a man called Sergeant Walter Popple, who was serving with the 8th Battalion of the Coilies. And Popple said that night came and I cautiously turned over and began to take stock. He was seriously wounded. He said, "I gently lowered the bandolier full of ammunition from my shoulders and the two hand grenades. Moving on my hands and knees, I crept to a large shell hole and, despite the bodies around it, began to make myself comfortable. The bullet, I realised, had hit flush on the front of my helmet, but instead of killing me outright, it must have ricocheted upwards with such force that it ripped the straps from my shrapnel helmet, sending it spinning into the air. The German, of course, would have assumed that I was dead. All through the night, incessant calls were being made for stretcher bearers, interspersed by rifle and machine gun fire. The next day followed the same pattern, except that we were shelling Jerry's frontline trenches with high explosive shrapnel, and at times crossed the shell hole where I was sheltering, wounding me in the right leg and shoulders, some 7 wounds in all. Back at Montauban, there was a man called Lieutenant Anthony Nash, and he was serving with the 16th Battalion of the Manchesters. And as we know, they had successfully taken the village of Montauban. At 9:30, just as the sun was beginning to go down, the Germans launched a very small counter-attack, which was beaten off. But Nash and his fellow officers were expecting further attacks. They really didn't know what was going to happen next as the night went on. He said no word of relief had been received and the situation was far too precarious to admit any of my men sleeping during the night. They were dead tired in spite of the rest I'd given them earlier in the day, and I spent the entire night walking up and down the line, watching and talking to the men to keep them awake. They were all very thirsty as they had no chance of refilling our water bottles since 5 p.m. on the 30th of June. One dear fellow gave me a spoonful of marmalade, which was the nearest approach to a drink that I'd had for 24 hours. Corporal Waldron, one of my best scouts, came running along down the trench in spite of a severe wound in his leg. He had been in charge of our extreme right post and reported that the redoubt of the 17th Manchesters had retired at the beginning of the fuss and they'd let the Germans in on our right flank. These Germans were then bombing their way down the trench with the intentions of clearing Montauban Alley. We had no bombs at all, so I borrowed some from the 55th Brigade on our left and then took a bombing party along the trench and sent another along the top to deal with the Huns. We drove them out of our own frontage and established a block where the 17th Battalion's post should have been. I was the only officer left in the front line and I presented a curious sight. My tunic and putties had gone long ago, the latter to put a tourniquet on Waldron's leg, and bareheaded and in my shirt sleeves, my face and arms covered with sweat and blood and grime, I looked anything but the conventional officer in command of a beleaguered garrison. The 16th Manchesters were finally relieved at 2:30 on the 2nd of July. Another soldier that was serving with them was a private, Edward Hickson. He said we started to retrace our steps to the assembly trench, back over the battlefield of yesterday, now strewn with thousands of our boys and the enemy. It was awful to see the boys who 48 hours ago were full of life, now lying upon the battlefield. We picked up as many wounded as we could and we took them to different dressing stations, then proceeded to a point of assembly to answer the roll call. The Sergeant Major was there calling out the names. Some were answered. Others would never hear their names again on this earth, but by this time would be answering the roll on the other side, for their entrance to that better land had been assured by the sacrifice they had made. They had laid down their lives for their brothers. Greater love hath no man than this. We often see those words as an inscription on the headstones in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, on the battlefield, and in other places where those soldiers are buried around the world. The officer, Anthony Nash, Lieutenant Anthony Nash, that we spoke about just now, he said from my battalion, 850 men and 22 officers went into action. 565 men were killed and wounded. Of the officers, Morton Johnson was killed, Allen was killed, Worthington was shot through the right lung and had his left hand shattered. Walker was blinded in both eyes. Hawley had his shoulder smashed. Kerry had a severe scalp wound. Hook and Morris were knocked out with machine gun wounds in the legs. Foo had his arm taken off by a shell splinter. Barr had his jaw smashed by a rifle bullet. Preston and Swain were hit early in the advance. Slack was wounded by the same shell that killed his servant. Hanscom was blown up by a trench mortar shell and had severe concussion. Megson got a machine gun bullet through his leg, and Elstob had a slight wound in the neck. Just describing the wounds of those officers there gives you some idea of what it must have been like on the Somme on that day. And don't forget, this is Montauban. This is the Manchesters, the Manchester and Liverpool pals. They were successful. They achieved their objectives that day. But further north at Teepval, the 14th Battalion of the Royal Irish Rifles, they were one of those units that were trying to unsuccessfully attack and take and keep and hold the Schwaben redoubt, but they couldn't do that. Lieutenant Colonel Francis Bowen, the commanding officer of that 14th Battalion, he said, at daylight on the 2nd of July, got parties organised and put them cleaning up castaway rifles, equipment, trenches full of debris, fallen trees, giants of the first mown down before the iron blast. Along the trenches lay men in all positions of death, just as they'd fallen. We collected wounded and sent to first aid posts, which was like a butcher's shop. Only a few naked poles left of all that was once Teepval Wood. Back at Montauban again, there was a Private Sidney Fuller serving with the 8th Battalion of the Suffolks on the 2nd of July. They were moving up across the battlefield towards Montauban. He said German dead were everywhere, many being in the dugouts, as if they died there after being wounded in the trenches. In the case of those Germans who had been killed in the trenches, most of them appear to have died fighting. Here and there along the parapets, or remains of parapets, were little piles of empty cartridge cases. In most cases, the Germans lay in the bottom of the trenches, near the empty cartridge cases, many having a bullet hole in the head. I saw one pile of three dead Germans, the top one having on only trousers and socks, the lower two being in full equipment. Stretcher bearers were searching the trenches among the dead for any who still had life in them. In the enemy front line, the enemy dead lay in threes in nearly every bay, some yellow in the face, some as black as negroes, and in every conceivable attitude. Private Joe Yarwood was serving with the Royal Army Medical Corps, the 94th Field Ambulance. He said the next day after the battle, the wounded were still waiting to be moved away, but we were lacking convoys. The dugouts had been turned into aid posts. There were piles of wounded lying on stretchers waiting for ambulances to move them. I'd just left the dressing station when we were shelled, but they landed with a pop and not an explosion. And then I got a whiff of it. It was tear gas. I rushed back to lend a hand, getting as many under cover as I could. They couldn't get their gas masks on. So for an hour, it was pandemonium trying to get these poor devils out of harm's way. I recall one poor devil who'd been buried in the bottom of the trench, but not deep enough, with the result that the top of his skull was exposed just level with the top of the trench floor. There was a bald patch right down the centre of this poor fellow's skull, where the troops had marched and worn the hair off his head. My God, what would his relatives at home think if they knew what had happened? A few minutes ago, we talked about Sergeant Walter Popple, 8th Coilies, who'd been wounded. And by the third day, he was still out there. He said he was exhausted. And it was on that day that a thunderstorm broke the terrific heat. By this time, all the bodies around me had turned black. One of them had a waterproof sheet protruding at the back of his pack. I formed a ridge and the water trickled down into my mouth. The fourth day was relatively quiet, but I realised that time was getting short. Unless help arrived soon, I was finished. I made my mind up that whatever happened, I must reach my lines by morning. Crawling throughout the night, I got to within a few yards of our trenches by daybreak. By a sustained effort, I rose to my feet and I hopped the necessary distance. Machine guns opened out, but I held my course, and I was lucky to enter one of the lanes cut for the attack. A sentry shouted, "Who's there?" I croaked coyly. To hear my own tongue being spoken was nectar. "And yours?" I said. "Middlesex," came the reply. "Anyone else out there?" I told him, "No." Possibly the unsung heroes of that night and day, the Royal Army Medical Corps, and in particular the stretcher bearers. We're going to look at one or two of their stories now. There was a Corporal W.H. Atkins who was serving with the Worcestershire Regiment as a stretcher bearer. And he wrote this poem, "We carry no rifle, bayonet nor bomb, but follow behind in rear of the still fringed line that surges along with a ringing British cheer through the tangled wire of the blown-in trench, spite of shrapnel or bursting shell. We make for the spots, khaki-clad, helpless blots that mark where our front rank fell. We are the men who carry them back, the wounded, the dying and dead. It's halt, dress in here. Come, buck up, old dear. You're all right for Blighty, so be good cheer. Turn him gently now, bandage his head. The stretcher-bearers doing their bit. Of VCs, not many they score, yet are earned every day in a quiet sort of way by the Royal Army Medical Corps. One of those stretcher-bearers wrote a book simply called Stretcher-Bearer. His name was Charles Horton. He went through the horrors of Passchendaele, Ypres and the Somme. He didn't want to fight because it was against these principles, which is why he joined the Royal Army Medical Corps instead. And when he became an old man in the 1970s, he thought that the sacrifices of the Royal Army Medical Corps were being forgotten, so he wrote down his memories. And this is what he said about the aftermath of the 1st of July. He said, "Pressing on, we came to Crucifix Corner." Now, as I've said before, there are several places on the Somme called Crucifix Corner, but the one he's talking about here is just behind Ovillers, and it's still there to this day. It's where so many of the wounded from that first day were brought on their way back through the evacuation route, and there's a restored crucifix that stands on that corner as the road goes up the hill towards Avaloux. And if you turn right, you head up towards Tietvaal through Ortwil. He said it was a road junction which was once marked by one of the wayside shrines, which is no longer visible. We halt and fall out to be divided into small groups, each of two or three stretcher parties of four. My group is told that we are bound for Ovillers. We are to relieve men from another section of the ambulance who have already done a spell at the post in question. While waiting for our guide, we climb a bank to which is possible to see the spot about a mile away for which we are destined. For the first time, we gaze upon what is known as the devastated area. Few people now living can have any conception of what the fair countryside of France suffered. From our vantage point, we look upon a man-made desert stretching to the horizon on which we can distinguish no landmarks but clumps of what were once trees clustered round little hamlets, but now lifeless sticks bereft of branches with no sign of any human habitation remaining above ground. Over one such clump of trees there appears, as we watch, a dark blotch of smoke, and this was exploding shrapnel. This, we are told, is Ovillers. We first march, or rather walk, as there is no longer any formality in our progress, along a road which has obviously been reconstructed with local materials. In a shallow valley on our right, many 18-pounder batteries discharging shells from time to time, with noisy reports and puffs of smoke and flame. Shell holes and old trenches are distinguishable by the chalk of upturned subsoil, and ahead we see more puffs of smoke in the summer sky. At length, we turn left into a shallow trench and at once become aware of that horrible stench, compounded of rotten human flesh and chloride of lime, which is to be in our nostrils night and day as long as we serve at the Ovillers post. As we negotiate repeated traverses, the trench grows deeper, but often we are able to see over the uneven parapet, and always there are bodies in German uniforms strewing the ground. Bodies have been used to build the parapet, and in places they lie not completely covered by earth under our feet. These have been German trenches, and our post is a German dugout, the first we've seen. The entrance is, I suppose, about 4 foot high, and now it's changed hands, naturally faces the wrong way. All the same, when one has descended the 6 or 8 steps to the floor below, and one finds one can stand upright and walk about in a chamber 10 or 12 feet square, one feels a considerable sense of security, a comforting prospect, at least for our off-duty spells. Another of those stretcher-bearers who served there was Tommy Crawford, and he wrote this poem, which he simply called The Stretcher-Bearer.
My stretcher is one scarlet stain as I tries to scrape it clean. I tell you what, I'm sick of pain for all I've heard, for all I've seen. Around me is the hellish night as the war's red rim I trace. I wonder if in heaven's height Our God don't turn away his face. I don't care whose the crime may be. I hold no brief for kin or clan. I feel no hate. I only see as man destroys his brother man. I wave no flag. I only know as here beside the dead I wait. A million hearts are weighed with woe. A million homes are desolate. In dripping darkness, far and near, all night I've sought those woeful ones. Dawn suddens up, and still I hear the crimson chorus of the guns. Look, like a ball of blood, the sun hangs over the scene of wrath and wrong. Quick, stretcher bearers on the run. O Prince of Peace, how long? How long?
We now turn once again to Lynn MacDonald's book, Somme, a book that I use quite often for this podcast. And in it, she quotes a private, Ernest Dayton, serving with the 8th Battalion of the Coilies. And his unit had gone over the top at what was called Nab Valley, not far from Teepvale, between Teepvale and Ovillers. And somehow his battalion had taken the first German line, but then before he reached the second line, he was wounded. And him and four others lay there for 2 days in a big shell hole between the first German trench and the second. And she quotes him, and he said, "I thought I was a goner. I didn't think I'd get back. I didn't think I'd ever get back. Lying out there that morning, I was within 25 or 30 yards of the German front line. I could have touched it. I had my finger on the trigger all the time, not moving, and I saw a few of them laid to rest. But it didn't do our lads much good. As soon as they started across, the machine guns opened up. It seemed like hours before they got up near to me. But they kept on coming. I still didn't move. These bullets are flying all over the place. It were Maxims. They were firing and they were shooting across each other with this hissing noise as they went past. I didn't turn round, but I heard the noise behind me and I knew our fellows were coming. Some of them were getting hit and they were yelling and shouting, but they came on. And when the first wave got up to me, I jumped up. I were in the first row, and the first one I saw were my chum, Clem Cunnington. I don't think we'd gone 20 yards when he got hit straight through the breast. Machine gun bullets. He went down, I went down. We got it in the same burst. I got it through the shoulder. I hardly noticed it at the time. I was so wild when I saw that Clem was finished. We got orders. Every man for himself and no prisoners. It suited me after I saw Clem lying there. Clem Cunnington's body was found after the battle and he's buried not far away in the Ovillers Military Cemetery. He says, I got up and picked up my rifle and got through the wire into their trench and straight in front of me there was a dugout full of Jerrys and one big fellow was on the steps facing me. I had this Mills bomb. I couldn't use my arm. I pulled the pin with my teeth and flung it down and I was shouting at them. I were that wild. There you are. Bugger yourselves. Share that between you. Then I were off. It was hand to hand. I went round one traverse and there was face to face. I couldn't fire one-handed, but I could use the bayonet. It was him or me, and I went first. Jab, just like that. It was my job. And from there I went on. Oh, how wild seeing Clem like that. We were climbing out of the trench, making for the second line, and that's where they got me again. Just as I was climbing out, through the fingers this time, on the same arm. I still managed to get on. I kept up with the lads nearly to the second line. Then I got another one. It went through my tin hat and down and straight through my foot. Well, that finished it. After a bit lying there, I saw two fellows drop into some shell hole. I crawled after them and, of course, you couldn't see much for the smoke. But next thing we did know, the Germans had taken back all of the front line. There were no more of our fellows about, so there we had to stop. So up to now, Ernest is describing Harry went over the top. Harry saw his mate killed. Harry got involved in hand-to-hand fighting and threw a Mills grenade into a German dugout. But now the sun goes down. It's night time. He's been wounded 3 times. He's stuck behind the German lines. The attack of his unit and elsewhere in that part of the battlefield has been a complete disaster. What is he going to do? As he said at the beginning of the passage, he thought he was a goner. The next passage describes exactly what it must have been like for not just him, but thousands of others. He said, when night came, I were in a deuce of a state. I must have been fainting off and on. What with the loss of blood? You'd no idea of the passage of time. I didn't know where I were. I only knew there were Germans in front and Germans behind, and I had no idea which way the British lines were. What with having nothing to eat and nothing to drink all day, my tongue was starting to get as big as two. I could hardly close my mouth. My water bottle was gone. I couldn't realise where I was. Lights going up all the time. All this noise. Then shelling from their side and shelling from ours and machine gun in between. What worried me was getting caught in our own shellfire. I bothered more about that. Well, they dropped in front of me and they dropped behind me, but they never put one into that shell hole. A little further to the south, just a matter of a few hundred yards away from Ernest, Gunner Frank Spencer is serving with the Royal Field Artillery, and he wrote in his diary that still more wounded came past the guns, day and into the night. Two of our signallers and an officer who'd gone through the infantry charge returned to us. The officer was slightly wounded, and the two signallers were suffering from severe shock, as they'd been buried. Also, one of the telephonists was missing, and another badly wounded. The duty of this little party had been to run out a telephone wire to keep us in touch with the advancing infantry. But they met with disaster and failed. They say that many of our poor wounded were shot by the enemy while trying to crawl back to the cover of our own trenches. But on the other hand, a German doctor and his staff was nicely captured whilst tending our own wounded. As nightfall approaches, our infantry are still fighting for La Boisselle. So we are still firing heavily through the night. So that piece of evidence there from Gunner Spencer tells us that the night wasn't quiet, the sun had gone down, but the firing continued, and those poor lads out in no man's land must have been absolutely terrified, because they knew that at any moment one of those shells, a burst of machine gun fire, could easily end their life. As night turned into day on that Sunday morning, Dayton was still stuck in that shell hole between the 1st and 2nd German lines. He was falling in and out of consciousness. He saw that the sun riding high in the sky, and that told him it was his second day lying out on the battlefield. He was in agony, and there was no sign of any rescue. He also noticed that one of his companions had died during the night. He said for a long time it was mercifully quiet. Then, alerted by some movement, a machine gun started up and bullets were zipping dangerously close to him. The shell hole was too shallow for safety. There was no possibility of moving, even if he could summon up the strength. A dead comrade was lying just below the edge of the shell hole, inch by inch and painfully slowly. Using his good shoulder and his uninjured hand, he managed to push the body up above the rim. He was only able to heave up the legs and part of the trunk. The arms and the head still hung down into the shell hole. As the machine gun swung through its traverse, he noticed that the bullets smacking into the body sounded exactly the same as though they were thudding into sandbags. That sounds awful, doesn't it, that he's using a dead comrade to protect him from that machine gun. But as he said in his notes, that poor chap had a few more bullets in him, it wouldn't make any difference to him. But for added horror, he noted that dead boy, his body was upside down, his contorted face was suspended quite near to Dayton's own face as he lay there in agony for the second day. To me, it seems absolutely unbelievable that Dayton was out there wounded until day four, when he saw dawn rising over the Somme. He was half starved, half frozen and half dead. But he heard the sound he'd been waiting for those four long days. It was the noise of thundering feet, and he saw British troops rushing past towards the second German line. They'd swept over the first line. Dayton had heard not a hint of the fight. Now he was fully conscious, and now he knew from the direction of the attacking troops where his own trenches lay. He also knew, with his strength falling away, that this was to be his last chance to get back to them. And he told Lew MacDonald this. He said, "I thought, here goes, I'm off. I knew I were a dead man if I didn't. I scrambled out and hobbled and crawled back as best I could. And even then, I didn't know whether I was going in the right way or the wrong way. When I got to not far off the first trench, this voice cried out, 'Halt!' And I just tumbled into it. They couldn't help me back further. They'd just taken that trench and they had to stop there. So somehow I got out of it and had to crawl all the way back across our own no man's land to our own front line. I managed to get to the barbed wire, where I found one bit of a gap and I went through it. It took me about 2 hours. It would have been 1,200 yards altogether. And when I tumbled into that trench, they said, "Who are you?" And all I could say was "Orange." That was our password on the first day, Orange. And I was gone, straight away, passed out. When I came round, I was lying there on the fire step, and they said, "The remnants of your lot are in Long Valley." So the stretcher bearers took me down to Long Valley. There was none of our lot there, just the medical officer. He was Captain Marshall, and he says, "Good God, this is 87 in now, there'll be no more." After that, they transported me down to the Canadian hospital, and I was down there 6 weeks. A bit that confused me there when he was talking about Long Valley, I'd not heard of that, but it's another name that was used for Blighty Alley, where there's now a cemetery. A couple of days later, the 13th Rifle Brigade left the reserve trenches on the Tara-Usna Ridge and made for the new front line at La Boisselle. Two lads, Walter Monckton and Joe Hoyles, they were brewing tea in the trenches when the colonel came along, accompanied by a staff officer. They both rose hastily to their feet and the two officers stopped before them. The trench ran to the left of the big crater, the crater that we now know is Lochnagar Crater. And since La Boisselle had fallen, it was a good distance behind the front line. It was exactly a week, almost to the minute, since the 34th Division had gone over the top and most of them lay there still with the bodies of the men who had followed them. And then climbing on the fire step, the staff captain cautiously raised his head above the parapet and he looked across. And he said, "Good God, I didn't know we were using colonial troops." Hoyles and Monckton exchanged grim looks. "Dear God," muttered Monckton, when the colonel and the visitor had moved away to a safe distance. "Has that bastard never seen a dead man before?" It was a rhetorical question. Lying out in the burning sun, soaked by the frequent showers of a week's changeable weather, the bodies of the dead soldiers had been turned black by the elements. The battalion spent the rest of that day burying them. Lynn MacDonald, I say this over and over again as I read that book, you realise what a massive contribution she made in her writing about the Somme, about Passchendaele, about some of the other elements of the Great War as well. She died recently and she'll be greatly missed. Back to the northern part of the battlefield. And as we know from previous podcasts, it was the 36th Ulster Division that were attacking the Schwaben Redoubt near Thiepval. And amongst them was a man called Albert Bruce. And at nightfall, he found himself sorting out the corpses in Thiepval Wood, where the Ulster Division attacked from. And his job was to remove the identity disc that was draped around the neck of each corpse. He then had the dreadful job of stacking 40 corpses in a dugout. And the idea was they would then be taken for burial. But then he heard moans coming from a pile of broken bodies. Immediately he tried to extract that man that was still living and move him away from the rest. And when he'd done so, he realised that that man was still alive. He sent for a stretcher, and the man was still conscious, and they placed him on that stretcher. To everyone's amazement, one of the soldiers that was standing nearby came across, saw what was happening. He looked long and hard at the pale face on the stretcher. And you know what? He realised that was his brother. Now, you would think that's a story with a happy ending, but I'm afraid it isn't. In a few moments, the stretcher bearers were heading back across the wood towards medical help. But then a shell must have hit the stretcher party. They never did reach safety. That man never saw his injured brother again. The man called Albert Bruce that's told us this story, he never saw any of that party again. Albert was to see the brother of the dead man several times after the war back home in Belfast. And every time he saw him, he would say to Albert, "Whatever happened to that brother of mine? Whatever happened to that brother of mine?" Now, the day after the 1st of July, it was a Sunday morning. And normally there would be church parades taking place behind the lines in rest areas. But those padres that would be carrying out those services didn't have time that morning to take many of those church services because they were helping bury the dead, deal with the wounded, some of them acting as stretcher bearers. And in the southern part of the battlefield, the 8th and the 9th Devonshires had advanced from Mansell Copse. This is a very famous story which we're going to cover in a podcast at some stage. But it's not the poet Hodgson nor Captain Martin that I want to talk about now. It's their battalion chaplain, a man called Ernest Cross. And Cross was one of those men that didn't want to be behind the lines. He wanted to be up there helping in any way that he could. And what he found he could do on the 3rd of July was to help with the burial of the Devonshires that had died. Going over the top 2 days earlier, there was 163 of them, and they'd been laid out in rows awaiting burial. He inspected every single man to ensure that his identity tag and personal belongings had been properly stored, and that way most of them, their identities, were known and are still known now when we visit that cemetery. Diggers were still busy preparing the last of the graves, and Cross checked that there would be a place for everyone. And then the following day, on the 4th, he buried every single one of them. The service took longer than expected because the guns were continuing to thunder around them, and he had to shout and make his words heard, as every single one of those soldiers that he buried had a proper Christian funeral. He thought at this stage that the offensive had been successful, so he ended with a prayer of thanksgiving for the victory, but even the sound of the guns made him doubt his own words. After the small congregation of comrades and officers had drifted away, Cross took off his robes and he joined the doctors and the diggers and the bearers filling in the graves. It took the rest of the day, and they barely had the strength to make it back to their dugouts afterwards. When he got back, Cross looked at his own hands. He had bare hands now. They were worn, calloused, and so deeply stained with mud that he thought he might never be able to get them clean. But I'm sure the relatives of those 163 men that he helped bury were very grateful that not only did they have a proper place of burial, but a proper funeral that was denied so many of the men that died on that day. Ernest Cross, like so many of the padres that served on the Western Front, really did provide a role far beyond the one that they were expected to deliver for those men. We now come towards the end of the podcast, and I've tried during the last hour or so to give an understanding of what it must have been like during the night after the 1st of July and in a few days later, how different people, just a small number of people, coped and dealt with what they had to do. But as with all of these stories, it's not possible to tell the whole story, I suppose. But what we do know is that the echoes and the effects, the shadows of what happened on the Somme on that first day and beyond continue to be felt even today. So you can imagine in the weeks and months that went by, everyone that was there on the 1st of July must have been greatly affected. But I would have thought that no one was more affected than the commanding officer of the 2nd Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment, a Lieutenant Colonel Sandys. His battalion was part of the 8th Division that attacked Upmash Valley towards Ovillay on the 1st of July. And when I say attacked, they didn't get very far. And if you go to the Ovillay Military Cemetery now and stand there and look out into that field, you're looking at what I think is the widest part of No Man's Land on the 1st of July. And that's one of the main reasons why the attack failed there. The German front line, it ran in front of Ovillay, and then it turned at a right angle and ran along the main, what's now the D929 road towards Albert. And it meant that the Germans could enfilade, could fire across the 8th Division as they moved through this valley of death. There were 23 officers in Sandy's battalion that moved forward at 0 hour. Only one of those returned unwounded. And there were 650 non-commissioned officers and other ranks that went over the top. And when the roll call was held the next day, only 50 of them answered the call. Now, we're told, aren't we, that these senior officers and generals and colonels didn't care. The myth has been told so many times over the decades. But, of course, those of us that have studied the Great War know that's not the case. And we've got evidence here because we know how badly Sanders was affected by the loss of his boys that he'd been with for 2 years. And how do we know how he felt? Well, because he took his own life a few weeks later, because he couldn't deal with the responsibility and the guilt that he felt about the loss of his men. I found a newspaper article dated the 14th of September 1916, and it tells us that the colonel has shot himself in a London hotel. It reports on the inquest and said that he died at St George's Hospital as a result of a bullet wound. It happened on the 6th of September. He'd taken a room at the Cavendish Hotel in central London, and he was found in bed with a revolver in his hand. There was a bullet wound in his head. He was taken to hospital but died. There was a Captain Lloyd Jones gave evidence at the inquest. He said that Sanders was single, aged about 40. He'd been wounded 5 times and been awarded the Distinguished Service Order for bravery. But since he left hospital, he'd been greatly depressed and very much distressed because of the attack on the 1st of July when his battalion had suffered so severely. He'd never threatened suicide, but said that he wished he'd been killed with his men. On September the 6th, the witness received a letter from Sanders, and in that letter Sanders said this: "I've come to London today to take my life. I've never had a moment's peace since July the 1st. There was a Captain Young, he gave evidence also at the inquest. He said that he was in the attack on the 1st of July when the battalion suffered severely and the deceased, meaning Sanders, was wounded. He said that Sanders had been greatly depressed since then, and in a letter which the witness received on the 6th of September, he wrote, 'By the time you receive this, I shall be dead.' The coroner remarked that the case revealed a pathetic tragedy of a very distinguished soldier who thought less of his own wounds than he did of the loss of his men." Sanders was a career soldier. He was indeed 40 years old. He'd served in Africa in 1898 and 1899. And his father was also a soldier, in a commanding officer in the Indian Army. And he'd been born in India. And he's now buried in the Brompton Cemetery in London. Sanders is, of course, not counted in the 57,000 casualties of the 1st of July. In reality, he was very much a casualty from that awful first day. And we remember him and all of the others that died, not just during the day, but who perished of their wounds or of dehydration or of hunger, maybe, over the next days and nights before they could be rescued in the Battle of the Somme in early July of 1916. We remember them, of course we do. And we remember them by the playing of The Last Post. Mm-hmm.